Good evening. This is the last Wednesday night summer series class, and we have Jeff Wilson with us from Kleinwood tonight, and he's going to be talking about the world's last night from Daniel 5. Jeff's been at Kleinwood since 2007, and he's here. His son Joel's here with us, and wife. Right. So I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. Let me take this mic off.
Well, good evening. Good to be with you tonight. I'm thankful for the opportunity. I invite you to open your Bible, Daniel chapter 5. That's pretty much where we're going to camp out tonight. Daniel chapter 5 in your Bibles. So one of the things about the stories, some of the classic stories of the Old Testament, is that we, especially those of us who have grown up around the church, we kind of learn them when we are younger, and we kind of, you know, whether it's in kids' Bible classes when we're young or VBS, stuff like that. And we often, you know, certain stories kind of get classified as kids' stories. And then once we get to be adults, we kind of go on and do, you know, Paul, and we do, you know, more complicated stories or more graphic stories or what have you. One of the things I've learned over the years, though, is it's interesting to go back and look at some of those classic, what we sometimes consider kids' stories for the children's classes, and go back and look at them with adult eyes and then begin to see if we notice something else or just think about them and from a little bit of a different angle. One of the things I've noticed about the stories in Daniel over the years is that a couple of things happen. Number one, there's a lot more going on than often what we picked up on when we were, you know, in kids' Bible classes growing up. But also that the stories in Daniel do tend to interconnect. They do tend to link together. We often kind of look at them individualistically and teach them individualistically, but they do kind of work together to paint a corporate composite portrait of life for God's people in Babylon. And there's a sense in which one of the things that I always take away when I read the book of Daniel, think about the book of Daniel, is that it's always Babylon out there. And we'll talk about that a little bit more before we're through tonight, the concept that we always live in Babylon. Daniel literally lived in Babylon, but Babylon in the Bible eventually just kind of becomes a metaphor for God's people living in the world in general, that it's always Babylon out there. And we'll look at that in the New Testament before we're through tonight. But Book of Daniel chapter 5, this story, of course, picks up with the reign of Belshazzar. Up to this point in the Book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar has been the king, and Nebuchadnezzar has done his ruling. And the last thing we see about Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel's book, and it really does set up chapter 5, is the story in chapter 4, right? Remember, Nebuchadnezzar gets very arrogant and decides that this is Babylon, Babylon the Great, that he has built by his power, his might, his strength, his glory, his honor, right? You go back and you read that in Daniel chapter 4. And so God humbles him. Remember, he loses his mind, becomes like a beast till seven times pass, until he learns that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he wishes. That Nebuchadnezzar has accomplished a lot, but it's only because God in his providence has allowed Nebuchadnezzar to rise to this level, Babylon to rise to this kind of dominance, and God runs history, not great men. That the way we usually tell the story of history, right? We study about George Washington, founding fathers. You know, we have our own great men. But the reality is, what God was trying to teach Nebuchadnezzar and us to this day is, you may have great men the way you tell the story, but at the end of the day, God rules. History unfolds the way he wants it to unfold. And the interesting thing about Nebuchadnezzar, for all the stories that we have from that point, and he really is one of the greatest monarchs the world has yet seen in his day and time. Babylon is one of the greatest empires the world has yet seen in its time. Babylon, the city, is one of the greatest cities the world has yet seen. We still talk about it. Parts of its archaeology are literally in European museums and places of honor. We talk about the seven wonders of the world, one of which was in the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It was one of the greatest cities in human history up to its point in time. And today, it sits in an Iraqi desert, turned to dust. All that we remember is what we have in the museums. And by the same token, the way God chooses to tell the story from Nebuchadnezzar's boasting in chapter 4, you literally turn the page to chapter 5 where we pick up tonight. And literally, from Nebuchadnezzar boasting about the greatness of Babylon, you turn the page and he's gone. It's that simple when God tells the story. We may tell history a certain way. Great people of history, great leaders, what have you. But when God tells a story, there are no great men. There are just men who know God, respect God, fear God, obey God. And there are men who don't realize that there is a God in heaven, and God uses them anyways, and then makes fools of them. The way God tells a story, this great man, you turn the page and he's gone. And not only when you turn the page is he gone, but literally, and this is why I call this way of approaching it the world's last night, from boasting in chapter 4 about his greatness and the city's greatness, you turn the page, he's gone, and you turn the page, and it's this last night of Babylon, because this is the story of the city's downfall, right? And not just the story of its downfall. This is literally when you turn the page from chapter 4 to chapter 5, Nebuchadnezzar boasting about the greatness of the city that he's built. This is literally the final hours of that city. Not only is the man gone, just with the turn of a page, but so is the city. These are the final hours of Babylon. So, have your Bible? Have your Bible? Let's read a little bit. I'm going to pick up Daniel chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. So, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, and that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. And then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and concubines drank from them. And they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and iron and wood and stone. All right, so stop right there for a second, that first paragraph. Think about the scene, right? Think about the setting. You have Belshazzar, and really, he's not actually the full king. His dad, Nabonidus, is actually technically the king, but Nabonidus is no longer in the city. Nabonidus is kind of in absentia. That's going to help us make sense a little bit why Belshazzar will offer Daniel the third place in the kingdom. The reason he does that is because Belshazzar is technically in the second place. And so Nabonidus, the true king, is already gone. Belshazzar is left there running things. And it's a picture, in one sense, of a virtual orgy. And the best of the brightest of Babylon are gathered. The elites, the leadership of the empire, are there. And I need you to think about a couple of details in this opening picture of the final hours of Babylon, having turned the page from chapter 4 when God says, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whoever he wants. And it's this. Number one, you have to understand how the ancient world worked. Cities didn't just fall down. They didn't have, you know, airplanes and air forces and missiles. They did not have, you know, shock and awe. They had armies on land and chariots, and they moved slowly, and you knew they were coming, and then they would surround the city, and they'd wait till you either ran out of food or water. It was called siege warfare, right? And so this is not a matter of the Babylonians are going to be surprised in a couple of hours when the city falls. They know the city is under siege by the Persians. They know the situation. This party goes on anyways. I don't know if you ever thought about that before or not, but that's how ancient warfare worked. It doesn't come out of nowhere. There aren't surprise attacks on major cities like that in the ancient world. That's not how it works. Armies are large, armies move slowly, and you know they are coming. That's why in other stories in the Bible, like when Ahaz is down checking his water supplies in the book of Isaiah, it's because he knows an army is coming. He's checking to make sure they have water. So when the enemy army arrives, they can stand the siege. That's how it works in the ancient world. So Nebuchadnezzar, or Belshazzar rather, throws this party knowing Babylon is in trouble, that the Persians are literally at the walls, at the gates. He knows Babylon's in trouble. So why do you do this? Why would you do this? If you were in Belshazzar's shoes, you talk to me a little bit. Why would you do this? Why would you throw a party like that when you know the city's in trouble and the Persians are at the gates? Truth? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, someone.
Probably all over.
Say again?
Everything's over.
Oh, well, so it's going out of business sale. There you go. It's a fire. Everything must go. Sure. okay. Why not? Yeah, truth?
Just thinking that let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die.
Okay. So the same thing, just kind of cynicism. We're doomed, so we might as well make beautiful corpses when we're dead. Okay. Anybody else got a different perspective, other possibilities? That's certainly one aspect.
Pride.
Maybe he wants to reassure the citizens.
Oh.
You know, they're out there, but they're not going to impact the way we do it.
Yes. Yeah, I want to come back to that. I do think there's certainly just the let's eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die, but there's also the PR aspect of it as well. Angel, did you want to say something?
Just to boast.
to boast. Yeah. Yeah. And in one sense, these things don't have to be mutually exclusive, actually, ironically. But let's not overlook the PR angle of it. Here's the thing. Babylon's walls were thick and they were great. They were powerful. Remember, you know, some of the ancient legends about being able to drive multiple chariots across them and whatnot. And so, if nothing else, if you think that your supplies are secure and your walls will hold, why not? Why not? And the other thing is PR. It matters, right? Inside the city, morale matters. Go back and read some of the stories in the books of Kings when Jerusalem would be under siege. For instance, in the Rabshakeh, when the Assyrians lay siege to Jerusalem in the Rabshakeh, the king's officials on the walls tell the Rabshakeh and his officials to not speak in the Hebrew language, because the people inside the city will hear and they'll lose morale. Morale matters when you're inside a city under siege. And so what you got to do is the leadership's got to show strength. The king's not worried. Why should you be? Everything's okay. He's partying like it's 1999 or no, that's a different song. But yes, sir.
Well, you also have the case of this is the son of the true king.
Mm-hmm.
The true king was not a very good king.
Yep.
This guy is basically inept.
Correct. Yep.
He doesn't understand siege. He doesn't understand warfare. He doesn't really even understand taking care of his people.
Right.
So
right.
He's just fiddling around thinking, oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
And it's not.
That's right. Because again, you know, that very, you know, as the chapter famously ends, that very night, this guy's dead. There's one detail in that first paragraph, I don't know if you noticed it, that helps us again maybe pick up a little bit more what this was about. You'll notice as they're having their party, their orgy, whatever it is, the king calls for vessels to be brought in verse 3. They bring out the vessels from God's temple, the stuff from Jerusalem, the stuff we haven't seen since Daniel chapter 1, when the last time it was explicitly mentioned at the beginning of chapter 1, at the very beginning of the story, when Nebuchadnezzar first lays siege to Jerusalem in the first place and first plunders the temple of God all the way back at the beginning of the story. We haven't seen those vessels since then. So they show up at the beginning of Babylon's encounter with the people of God. Those temple vessels show up at the end of Babylon's encounter with the people of God. And part of why Belshazzar would probably do this is, again, PR, right? Bring out war spoils from previous great battles to show, previous great victories and conquests to show we're still Babylon, right? When all else fails, when morale is low, and when you're in trouble, fly the flag and remind yourself of the great history and, you know, we are Marshall or, you know, whatever. That's what people do. And so that's the stage in which this story takes place. The king is not worried, and you shouldn't be either. All right, let's keep reading. Verse 5, depending on your translation, suddenly, or maybe immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hips joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explains interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple, a necklace, have a gold necklace around his neck, and have authority as the third ruler." And now we know why. The third ruler, because Nabonidus is the first, Belshazzar is the second, so you can only have spot number 3. You have the third authority of the third ruler in the kingdom. So all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation of the king. This sounds like a lot of other stories in Daniel, doesn't it? You know, king has dream, king has vision, king is concerned, king calls for wise men, they can't do it, and so you need one of those Jewish exiles to come in and save the day. We've read these kind of stories before. So King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed because nobody could interpret this handwriting. So the queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the kings and his nobles, and the queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." So Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, and I want you to notice how he addresses him. "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, who my father the king brought from Judah. I want you to notice the contrast. We'll come back to this in a minute, but notice the contrast between how the queen described him, the greatness of him, the elevation of him, what he's accomplished in the past, versus Belshazzar, when he's brought in, saying, are you that guy, Daniel the exile? It's a stunning, you know, from the honor in which the queen speaks of him to the lowly way in which Belshazzar speaks of him, especially given by this point, Daniel has served the empire loyally for decades. Daniel is an older man by this point in the story, because if Daniel chapter 1 is about 605 and this story is about 539, you do the math. Daniel is a senior citizen by this point who has served the empire for decades. The queen shows him respect. All Belshazzar still sees is, are you that guy, the exile? Language matters, and how you talk about people matters. How the story is told matters. Well, Belshazzar goes on, verse 14. Now, I've heard about you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now, the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple, wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler of the kingdom. And so here we have, and it's interesting, I want you to notice the language, the very first word of the paragraph that we picked up in verse 5. Notice, as we go back through this now, notice, the first word is immediately. Or suddenly. You see that? If you're an underliner, highlighter, Bible marker, that's a word that you might notice or mark. Here's why. Because that's exactly how life works. You're living in the world, you're living for self, you're having a good time, you're distracting yourself, you're telling yourself comforting phrases and cliches in a moment of in a fallen and difficult world. And then suddenly something happens in life that makes it impossible for you to notice the reality of your predicament and situation. That's how life often goes, isn't it? You're going along, and then it's all of a sudden, it's a call from the doctor's office. The test results gave us concern. We need you to come back in. That happens, right? You're going along, and you go to work one morning, and your boss says, we need to meet. And the next thing you know, you're being handed a cardboard box and being told it's over. This is exactly how life works, folks. Suddenly, immediately. That's how often the big moments in life come. You rarely see them coming over the horizon. Suddenly, the real situation unveils itself. Suddenly, in an instant, that's how life works. We put all our hope and confidence in the gold and silver, the treasure of our world and lives, put all our hope in our power, position, and our wealth, our popularity, but in a verse in the Bible, in a moment in life, in a phone call, everything changes. And we're faced with a situation where we have no answer, no idea of even what's going on anymore or what we should do about it. Here, up until that point, is one of the most powerful men in the world up to that point in history. The Babylonian Empire has been the peak and pinnacle of human power, accomplishment, civilization, education, you name it. And this man's at the top of the pile up until that moment. In the greatest city in the world, presiding over what up until that point has been the most powerful empire the world has ever seen. And just like that, all the confidence, all the arrogance, all the bravado, all the celebration, all the PR, all the spin mastering, it's all meaningless. All the security of the walls and the military, the army, all the boasting and previous great victories, all of it means nothing. From pretend triumph to real terror, from partying to prostrate, from supreme to speechless, suddenly, just like that, because that's how life actually works. This is a story from which we get our saying, the handwriting is on the wall. It becomes obvious, no matter how hard you've tried to deny something, that this is reality. You can party all you want, you can remember the past, but the handwriting's on the wall. And in that moment, it's interesting what Belshazzar does. He does what a worldly person can do, but it's not much. He turns to the educated experts, the credentialed PhDs, the doctors in the medical center. He calls all the experts in the various spheres. He calls the Chaldeans, the diviners, the sorcerers. He calls all those kind of people in. He calls the credentialed experts in, and they have nothing. And he offers all that he can offer. He offers wealth, and he offers a job title. That's all he has to offer in those moments. And in that moment, suddenly, all of it, from the credentialed experts and their so-called expertise, to the rewards that he can offer, all of it's shown to be worthless, meaningless, empty. No answers, no solutions, no clarity. The king offers all that Babylon has to offer if only somebody can make it go away. And none of them could. I don't know if you've ever thought about this or not, but think about this story from the adult perspective a little bit more. Have you ever wondered, why is Belshazzar troubled in the first place? You ever thought about that? I mean, that's the challenge with a familiar story, right? Think about this with me for a minute. That's the problem with a familiar story. We know the story so well. We've heard it so long, many of us, since we were little kids. So we know what this story is. We know where it goes. We know what it means. And we know it's bad news. We already know that. We can't read that story anymore without really, you know, knowing it's bad news. Of course it is. And yet, if you're in Belshazzar's shoes and you don't know the end of the story yet, you haven't gotten to the end of chapter 5. You don't know the end of the story yet. You ever wonder why Belshazzar simply assumes it's bad news? You ever thought about that? How does he not possibly even think about the possibility? Maybe it's one of his gods. Maybe it's Marduk showing up. Maybe it's Bel. Maybe it's one of his gods showing up. And maybe what the message really means when properly interpreted is actually good news. Good news, the Persians will not prevail. Good news, it's your birthday and you get a pony. I mean, I don't know, but how does he know it's not good news? You ever thought about that? He just somehow immediately knows. Knees knocking, bowels loosed. He just somehow intuitively knows it. But you ever wonder why? It's interesting. Maybe it's his conscience. Paul talks about Romans 1, right? There is a God. You may not know him through revelation, but the creation itself simply screams that there is a God. He is powerful. He is beyond us. And you really ought to spend the time that you have in life figuring out who he is and what he wants. That's the best possible use of your time. Everything else is distraction. Maybe it's that conscience that Paul talks about in Romans 1. Maybe that was triggered in those dark moments because he knows what's outside the city walls. He knows the truth of what the doctors have diagnosed him with. He knows the truth about his financial situation. You know, pick whatever modern analogy we sometimes try to pretend and distract ourselves from sometimes. He knows the reality. The Persians are at the walls and we are in real trouble this time. And all the partying in the world, all the distraction, can't take his mind off of it. When something inexplicable and supernatural shows up, it's almost like intuitively he knows, this is not Marduk here to bail me out. This isn't Bel. This isn't Ishtar. This is something else. It's almost like he deep down in that moment knows his gods don't do this. Deep down, he knows it's all a lie. It's all facade. That's one of the things that's interesting in doing what I do in life. It's interesting when people decide to come knocking on the church doors and wanting to talk about their life and how they're living. It's when they've been to the doctor and something bad has come out. When something bad's happened in their family, usually one of their kids. But when something happens in life that forces you to drop the lies and the facade and the pretend and the make-believe and realize the gods of this world really don't deliver, and it's time for me to get serious about ultimate reality. He knows deep down his gods don't do this. But you have to almost wonder if maybe as he's parting with those gold and silver vessels from Yahweh's temple in Jerusalem, remember we saw that in verse 3? You almost have to stop and wonder if he has a brief moment of realization. I have heard stories though about the God who used to own this cup. I've heard some of those stories over the years. That God does stuff like this. He may not be real happy.
Well, he obviously knew the story of Daniel. He knew Daniel.
Yeah.
He knew what Daniel had done.
Yeah.
In his education, he knew.
Yeah.
And so at that moment, he goes, I've been following the wrong gods here.
Yeah. Well, and to that point, we're going to see in just a minute when we go to the next paragraph, something Daniel says, again, you go back and you read this with adult eyes and with, you know, an adult's, you know, kind of taking in all the details. There's a line Daniel throws before Nebuchadnezzar that drives at that very point, I think. All right. So we have Belshazzar's conversation with Daniel. Remember, Belshazzar has been mocking, blaspheming God by using God's holy items from the temple in his pagan orgy, mocking the God who owns these things. And it's interesting. Let's go back and let's read here for a little bit more. Verse 17, let's kind of go towards the end of the story here, and then we'll unpack it a little bit more. Verse 17, so Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar your father. And notice how Daniel talks, verse 18. In distinction to chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar saying, I've done this. Daniel knows exactly how to frame it. God did this through and with your grandfather. Verse 19, because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed. Whomever he wished, he spared alive. And whomever he wished, he elevated. And whomever he wished, he humbled. Verse 20, but when his heart was lifted and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. Refers him back to chapter 4. That story, you should have known this. This is your family history. He was also driven away from mankind. His heart was made like that of the beast. His dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High is the ruler of the realm of mankind and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though, and here's the line, even though what? You knew all this. Here's the adult version of the story. Part that we sometimes forget because we don't all, you know, and at least when I was, my mom was telling more about how I was raised. We did this story, handwriting on the wall, and, you know, and God throws Babylon down. This intertwining, at least I never picked up on until I was older. Daniel flat out says to Belshazzar, you knew this. Which means what we've been doing tonight, what you've been doing tonight, you knew better. That's probably why he knew this would not be good news. Whatever this hand has written, it's not going to be good news. Because the God whose cup I'm holding is known to do things like this. And that's part of how Daniel condemns him. You knew this. Verse 23, but you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. You have, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. See, Daniel makes a big deal about those temple vessels. Verse 3, back when introduced them. Daniel makes a very big deal about that. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways, you have not glorified. Then the hand was sent from him, and the inscription was written out. So after preaching the sermon, Daniel finally gets to what Belshazzar really would know anyways. What does this even mean? But the sermon's what matters. This is why all this has happened. You knew better than to do what you did tonight, Belshazzar, which is why the hand has been sent. And now we can talk about Mene Mene Tekelu Farsin. This is the interpretation of the message. And here's the thing. Mene Tekel and Ufarsin. These words in themselves are Aramaic. It's not that Belshazzar would not have been able to literally read them. He just wouldn't have known what to do with them. The words are clear. There's nothing magical about them. If you read Semitic languages, these are just straight Semitic roots. The question is, what does the deity, the God who has done this, what does this deity mean by these? Mene literally just comes from the word for numbering. But this one is repeated, numbering. And it's God's way of saying, you know, riffs off the numbering angle. God has numbered your kingdom and put it into it. It's the idea of numbering, of accounting, of going through and auditing. That's maybe the closer the word that we would use today. God has audited you. In fact, Mene, Mene, the repetition emphasized, he has thoroughly, thoroughly audited you. He's gone through the numbers. He's checked the books, not financially speaking, but morally speaking. He has absolutely audited you and your kingdom. And he repeats it twice, kind of like a certain guy who's making a list and checking it twice, no mistakes. Yeah, it's God's way of emphasizing, I have absolutely I have absolutely evaluated you completely, comprehensively, thoroughly, and my judgment is certain. The second one, tekel. Tekel's a little bit weird to us, but you do know this word, and now it's Aramaic, but it's Hebrew form. Shekel, shekel, tekel. Just one of the consonants changes. It's actually a word for weighing. A shekel was not just a unit of the money, it was a unit of the money in a sense of a weight. You know, a shekel was a weight, a certain value that way. And so now what God is saying, after I've numbered you, I've audited you, I've gone through and looked at all the details and sifted and numbered it twice, and I've audited you, I've weighed you. The difference between numbering and weighing is this, maybe, if we're trying to get the metaphor. I've weighed you. We talk about somebody who has gravitas versus somebody who's all fluff, right? How much substance is there to you, Belshazzar? And you come up light. There's just nothing much to you. You're all show, no substance. You're not much of a man because you don't fear God. That's what puts ballast in the human soul, isn't it? The fear of God. What does it mean to be human? Remember what the preacher says in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, very beginning of it? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is what?
Man's all.
This is man's all. Some modern translations, for this is the whole duty of man, but in Hebrew, it's really kind of poignant. Literally, this is just kol adam. Literally, this is just all of the human. This is what it means to be human. If you want to have ballast to your humanity, it's fear God and keep his commandments. You lose that, you don't weigh much in God's eyes. And so you've been weighed, and there's no substance to you. And then the last one, and maybe this is actually the one that really, Magby, actually rattled Belshazzar even more, that this is bad news, because there's a word play in this, upharsin. In Semitic languages, it's not the vowels that matter, that carry the meaning as much as the consonants. And so when you look at the consonants, P-R-S, it literally is an Aramaic root that means to divide. Your kingdom will be divided. In other words, it'll be parceled out. It will not be yours anymore. You'll lose control of it. It'll be divided up and given away. But it also is a wordplay off of the group outside the walls known as the Persians. That's actually, we call them Persians. That's actually the Anglicization of the English is Anglicization, yeah, of their name from their language. And so literally, if you're speaking these languages back and then, literally it's a word that means to divide, to take away, to parcel out, but you hear the echo of Persian in it. And that would not have been lost in Belshazzar speaking these languages as a native speaker. He would have heard the echo of the people outside the walls in that word. The people who your kingdom is being divided, parceled out, given to are the people outside the walls. You're done. Look at verse 29. So very, very typical. After Daniel begins the sermon and the interpretation with, I don't want your stuff, what does Belshazzar do anyways? Gives him the stuff. Because that's all he knows, and that's all he has. And he's not going to learn the lesson, apparently. And when you've lived a certain way for so long, it's almost like reflex. Isn't that a terrifying thought that you can get to a point where you've lived so long in the world's way of thinking, of valuing, of acting, that even in your darkest moments, you just return to form like autopilot. It's just who I am and what I do. And that's Belshazzar. Belshazzar gave orders. They clothed Daniel with purple, put a necklace of gold around his neck, issued a proclamation concerning that he now had authority as third ruler in the kingdom. And you can put parentheses there for a few hours. Because verse 30 is perhaps then the most potent sentence in the whole story. That very night, Belshazzar was slain. That very night, Belshazzar was slain. Mene, mene, tekel upharsin. It's a powerful story. And again, I really do think it speaks to where we live in a lot of ways these days. Let me make three quick observations, and then we'll wrap up together. Number one, part of what it means to live in Babylon, what this story reminds us, is that we need to watch out for all the hazards all around us. The reality is Belshazzar was surrounded by danger. It was a great moment to turn to God, and he doesn't. It was a great moment as he held those temple vessels to decide to put the party on hold and begin to think about the God who has done so much, the God who had humbled Nebuchadnezzar, his ancestor, whose story he knew and chose to set aside anyways. I'm in a room like this, and I'm talking to people who know the stories of God. That's why you're here. The question is, what danger outside the walls of your life are you flirting with tonight? What do you need to change? What needs to be different before suddenly happens in your life? Because all of us live long enough, something suddenly is going to happen. Something suddenly is going to bring an end to our life. A sudden diagnosis, a sudden accident, but one way or the other, suddenly comes for each and every one of us at some point. And so we need to learn to live in the reality of the fact that we are surrounded by the world's hazards, just like Babylon was. Belshazzar is confident in who he is and what he has, and look what happened. That very night, Belshazzar is slain. Number two, the handwriting is on the wall. Mene, mene, tekelu, farsin. The fact of the matter is, folks, that's how God runs the world. Remember that story, Luke chapter 12, the parable Jesus told of the rich fool? Guy who had an abundance, had so much, in fact, he had nowhere to put it all. Sound like your house? Got a storage unit, maybe? No judgment, I'm just asking. Got so much, I don't know what to do with it. So what did he decide to do? Tear down his barns, build bigger, because soul? Just like Nebuchadnezzar, he talks to himself about himself, just like Nebuchadnezzar. Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years, so what should you do in the meantime? Take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. And remember how that parable worked? It's almost like a clone of this in New Testament garb. That very night, his soul was required of him. And then in the parable, God asks, and then whose will these things be? Each of us, folks, is being numbered by God. Each of us is being weighed by God. And whatever we have and hold in this life will eventually be divided from us. There are no U-Hauls and funeral possessions. You don't take it with you. I've done enough funerals over the years to watch the family. I remember one time years ago after doing a funeral, literally that very night, we did the funeral in the morning, that very night, got a call from one of the kids. The family was fighting over the assets. You're dead and gone, you leave it all behind, and then everybody else squabbles, depending on how dysfunctional the family is, squabbles for the leftovers. Numbered, weighed, and divided. Handwriting's on the wall for each of us, too. That's the end for each and every one of us. Will it be good news or will it be bad news, though, when it comes your day to be numbered and weighed? And number three, you need to make your choice. Are you going to ignore this story or are you going to live in light of it? Right? That was Belshazzar's great problem. He knew the story. He knew the story. That's what Daniel reminds him. You know the story, Belshazzar. You just didn't choose to live in light of it. How about you and I, folks? Again, I'm talking to a room full of people tonight. You know the stories. We've heard this story since VBS when we were kids, since we were kids' Bible classes. Many of us have known this story all our lives. The decades have gone by. Are you living in light of the story or not? That's the question, isn't it? I call this lesson, when I do this and when I teach on this chapter, I call it the world's last night for a reason. Because literally for Belshazzar and for Babylon, for those who had built their lives around Babylon's ways and Babylon's values, those who had lived their lives to have a share of Babylon's power and wealth, those who had spent their lives chasing a nice house and a good zip code with access to highly rated schools for their children, those who had worked hard with their kids and raised them so they were able to get admission to their first choice college and so forth. You know, ancient Babylon, modern Babylon, same kind of thing, right? We live by the system's values if we're not careful. But when ancient Babylon fell, those folks were left with nothing, not even their very lives. And the point for us, folks, is the city always falls. The city always falls. Because either your life ends or your civilization ends if history goes on long enough. You realize 300 years ago, there wasn't a United States. You realize 300 years ago, Britain, the monarchy was the big power, right? Remember, the British Empire was the empire on which the sun never sets, right? You remember all that? Remember all that? And today, Britain can't even hardly fund one aircraft carrier. the nation that used to control the oceans, colonize the planet, and today they can barely field a respectable modern navy. You think that day won't come for the American way of life too? Mene, mene, tekelu, farsin. But it's so hard in the meantime, especially if we're not morally compromising ourselves, it's hard not to live by the value system to some level. It's hard to teach our kids to stay outside that value system, that there's something more important than where you get into college. But what gate you get to go through in the last day. When you die, the world ends for you. When nations fall, the world as people have known it ends. The world as the Babylonians know it ended that night. It was the world's last night for Belshazzar because he died. For the survivors of that evening, it was the world, into the world as they had known it. The sun comes up, the Persians are in control, and life will never be the same again. Some of us are a little bit older. We've lived long enough. We've had a taste of that, all right. Remember, there's between September 10th, 2001, and September 12th, 2001, those of us who have been around a while. It was a different world before and after 9/11, wasn't it? You used to be able to keep, well, now you can keep your shoes on again at the airport, I guess, but you used to be able to go through no security. I remember one time, I think it was about 1998, I was running late for a plane. I ran literally from the curb to the gate without ever being checked by security one time in 1998. They just waved me through because I didn't look like a threat. I was just a goofy looking young kid. Can you imagine that happening today? I'd be serving 25 years in the federal penitentiary right now for pulling this down like that. They didn't shoot me. There's a world that ended on 9/11/2001 for those of us who are old enough to remember before and after. And those of you who were younger, you know, you live long enough, you may well have that kind of experience in your own life, in this country, its history, its ways of doing things. The world always ends. Immediately, suddenly, that's how it works. 9/11 was pretty sudden, wasn't it? Those of us who lived through it, that was pretty sudden. I remember it was a Tuesday. Monday night, I watched Monday Night Football. I still remember that game simply because Ed McCaffrey, Christian McCaffrey's dad, you younger ones know Christian McCaffrey. Now, Ed McCaffrey's dad was playing. He broke his leg. He was playing for the Denver Broncos, broke his leg that night. That's why I remember that game. I liked Ed McCaffrey. He's a great receiver. Broke his leg that game. That's why I remember it. And then Tuesday morning happened. Had no idea when I went to bed Monday night, staying up way too late watching football. The world as I knew it was ending. You live for God, you're never really surprised because you know the story. You know the story. This is how it always works. One of two things is going to happen. You're going to die, or Jesus is going to come back. Suddenly. You know the story. Questions, are you living in light of it? All right, I've talked long and rambled on a bit. You talk to me. Anything you want to add, say, suggest, applications you would contribute, observations for the final bell comes in those last 30 seconds or whatever it is. Does that make sense? Do you see how the power of the story works? And we live in these stories. These stories seem ancient, but they're really very modern. All of us live in a city that's under siege. Jesus is coming back. It's going to end. What are you doing in light of it? No takers? Yeah, that's what happens sometimes. I get too enthusiastic. Well, I appreciate your letting me rant at you for a few minutes. I hope it's beneficial to you. I do appreciate the time. Appreciate the invitation. Good to be with you as always. I appreciate this congregation so very much. I don't think it personally that Daniel's not here tonight. It's kind of funny. I was doing Southside 2 weeks ago, and Bubba was over here. And so I'm noticing a pattern. Wherever I go, the local guy seems to go to the opposite congregation. So I'm trying to take that personally. But no, it's all good. Well, I appreciate the attention this evening. Good to be with you as always. And we'll be dismissed for a couple of minutes here.